Welcome to Political Hitman on Israel News Talk Radio. Want to connect with Howie? Email him at howie@israelnewstalkradio.com. Now here's your host, Howie Silberger.
Giving in to the pressure following the deportation of Danish Jews to Theresienstadt, the Germans permitted representatives from the Danish Red Cross and the International Red Cross to visit the camp in June of 1944. It, of course, was all an elaborate hoax. The Germans had testified the deportations from the ghetto shortly before the visit, and the ghetto itself was beautified. Gardens were planted, houses were painted, and barracks were renovated. The Nazis staged social and cultural events for the visiting dignitaries. Once the visit was over, however, the Germans resumed deportations from Theresienstadt to Auschwitz, to Dachau, to Majdanek. And the hoax of Theresienstadt didn't end till October 1944. Now, everybody was convinced. Danish leaders, including King Christian, were convinced. The Red Cross was convinced that the Nazis were treating their hostages correctly, that the Jews of Theresienstadt were being treated okay, and there was nothing to worry about, and that it was all humane. Hey, look, they had cultural events. Hey, look, they lived in clean barracks. Hey, look, they had food, they had water. Nobody looked overly hungry. Nobody looked like they were being tortured. Nobody looked like they were being hurt in any way. Now, we all know that the so-called Palestinian leadership takes their playbook directly from the Nazis. We know this for many years. They were trained in Nazi tactics starting in the 1940s with Haji Amin al-Husseini coming back from leading the SS in Croatia and training Arab armies to act exactly like the Nazis did. He was an aide to Hitler. And so he trained his Arab armies to act like Nazis. He trained them to be barbaric, like the Nazis were. And he trained them to hate Jews, much like the Nazis did. And so the Arab leadership, through the generations, continued that training, continued to teach this barbarism, continued to teach that Jews were subhuman, and that the State of Israel had to be destroyed because of the subhumans of Jews. Used Islam as a cover to disguise their Jew hatred and continued to try to advance Hitler's policy of making the world Judenrein, making the world devoid of Jews. On October 7th, thousands of Arabs stormed into Israel through the border of Gaza and killed 1,500 Jews. The world didn't care. Nobody cared. They kidnapped hundreds of Jews. Nobody cared. Nobody called. There were no mass rallies calling for the release of these Jews. The release of the people who were taken hostage. They weren't all Jews, by the way, but nobody got into the streets to call for their release. Americans were being held hostage. The Americans didn't even call for the release of their American counterparts. Because as long as it's Jews that are the victims, nobody cares. And so finally, Israel was cowed into accepting a deal with Hamas where they would trade hundreds of known terrorists with blood on their hands, to take back living and dead hostages. They were forced to treat Hamas as if they were a legitimate entity rather than a terrorist organization. And they were forced to believe Hamas that they were going to release these people as they said they would. And Hamas started releasing them. And the first batch of hostages that were released, the first batch of captives that were released, looked like they were in good shape. And the world started reporting, oh, Hamas is not that bad of an organization. Look, they took care of the terrorists. Look how good shape these people are. Yeah, of course, they were held captive in people's homes and they were fed and they were taken care of. Nobody was really injured. Take a look at them. These people were not tortured. And much like Theresienstadt, the word started spreading, the hoax started spreading, that Hamas took care of their hostages. And then the second round and the third round of hostages looked the same. They looked like they were being taken care of. But then Hamas said, hey, wait, some of the hostages are dead, and the rest that we're releasing may not be in such great shape. And it was true. And so you figure, after holding people hostage for over a year, for about a year and a half, 491 days, 492 days, Hamas would have a little bit of sympathy for these people and let them go in this hostage trade, which is let them go. Hostage for terrorist trade. But they didn't. Instead, they paraded them on stage. They forced Eli Sharabi to speak and say how much he looked forward to seeing his wife and daughters upon his release. How excited he was to be going home to his family. They knew, he didn't, that his wife and daughters were killed on October 7th. They were murdered on October 7th. Hamas knew that, but they never told him. And they let him give a speech saying how much he looked forward. They forced him to give a speech saying how much he looked forward to seeing his family. Barbaric, cruel, and unusual punishment. And the world remained silent. When Eli Sharabi walked onto stage, he was barely able to walk. He had lost a lot of weight. If you look at the before and after pictures, it was an incredible amount of weight he's lost. But the world didn't care. Nobody said a word. Crickets. Also released were Or Levy and Ohad Ben-Ami. And they were debriefed by Israeli security teams. And they disclosed harsh treatments about the torture they suffered during their captivity by Hamas terrorists in Gaza. This torture included being hung from their legs, upside down. They were all subjected to horrific physical torture and were taken separately for brutal interrogations, during which the terrorists demanded information from them while imposing severe physical abuse. They choked them. They tied them up. They tied their mouths with ropes and strangled them. They hung them up by their legs and burned them with hot objects. They say they were deliberately starved and not receive any food at all for days on end. Every few days, they would receive a rotten pita, which they had to share with the other hostages who were held together with them. Moreover, they did not drink for long periods of time as they were not given water. At one point during this captivity and this torture, due to subhuman hunger and thirst, one of the hostages collapsed. The other hostages who were with him thought he was dead, prescribing this moment as particularly traumatic. The two men said that they were quite relieved when he wasn't dead, but they were sure that they were looking at a dead man. This is what these people had to go through as hostages in Hamas terror tunnels. This is what thousands of people are standing in the street and supporting when they're yelling, dismantle Israel, glorify the Intifada, globalize the Intifada. This is what they're yelling. This is what they're screaming. This is what they're advocating. This is exactly the way they want Jews to be treated when they globalize the Intifada. This is what the Intifada is. And we're starting to see the globalization of the Intifada. It's starting to happen as we live. I've told you many stories over the last few weeks about things that have happened around the world that have been glorifying the Intifada, that have been globalizing the Intifada. And there's more. There's much more. There's always something. Every week, there's another attack on the Jewish community. Every week, the Jews are being harassed and bombarded around the world by Jew haters who have found they're free to come out and hate Jews publicly, and nobody's going to stand against them. Nobody's going to care that they come out and hate Jews. That it's now all part of the national culture of whatever country they're in. That's acceptable behavior to hate Jews. It's mind-bogglingly crazy to think that there is an acceptance, a global acceptance, for the hatred of Jews and the expression of the hatred towards Jews. In New York, just yesterday, or a couple of days ago, two Hasidic men were assaulted in the Crown Heights neighborhood as they were exiting a synagogue. The attacker was unprovoked and attempted to stab one man in the neck and push another one to the ground. He wounded both of them. The assailant also made threats to passerbyers before being stopped by Crown Heights Shmira, which is a citizens on alert organization, and they held him in custody. They tackled him and held him down until the police showed up. The men received medical care. The attack, which occurred in the heart of the Lubavitch community, took place precisely on Yud Shvat, the anniversary of the previous Rebbe's passing and the beginning of the Rebbe's leadership, Chabad said in a statement. They added that this day symbolizes strength and continuity, and this act of hatred only reinforces the determination to respond with even more light. A very strong response by Chabad over an attack, a blatant attack on their members. The same day that these two Hasidic men were attacked in New York, Kanye West, a rapper, a very famous rapper, a very famous anti-Jewite, tweeted, "I am a Nazi." That's what he wrote. "I am a Nazi." Now, we all know Kanye West is a Jew hater. He has made no bones about it. He has been a Jew hater for years, and he's made no bones about it. So no one's really surprised that Kanye West is saying, "I'm a Nazi." But why he's allowed to do this, and why he's allowed to continue to have a platform, and why he hasn't been canceled like other people have been canceled for saying much less, is beyond me. Now, Rabbi Dov Landau, he's the head of the Slavdoka Yeshiva, one of the Lithuanian community's greatest leaders. He called for Arabs to rule Israel as they had in the past, Haredi media reported last Friday. Reminiscing, he said, "Is it possible to live well with the Arabs without a state?" He advocated for Arab rule over Israel, saying, quote, "It would be quite good if the Arabs ruled here. The best situation, if the Arabs would rule, they would respect Zionists, not interfere with them, bring money to the country. The Arabs love money," he said. He said that had the Jews properly submitted themselves to King Faisal over 90 years ago, the conflict wouldn't have happened. Quote, "If the Arabs had received such treatment, the situation would have been different. They also made the Arabs hate us. Never before had the Arabs been so hated in the whole world," he continued. "They'll stop one day. It's impossible to believe them anymore. Maybe a huge concession could be made. I don't know what to say politically. I don't know. And what you don't understand shouldn't be talked about." Landau attacked religious Zionism and their rabbis in response to a question by a visiting rabbi. The rabbi arrived to ask Landau where the Torah study had saved Israel from the Arabs. One rabbi complained to him of the many young men who were surrendering their souls and getting killed in order to protect people and the land. Landau responded saying that they were being killed because their religious Zionist rabbis had distorted Torah. "They brought physical disaster, not just spiritual ones, to the people of Israel," he said, in reference to Zionism, which he believes is incompatible with Judaism. Well, Rabbi Landau and the people who stand against the Jews who are going to defend Israel, soldiers who go out and try to defend Israel and defend the Jewish people, they are working contrary to Judaism. And I don't say that lightly because I don't often talk badly about people who are holy and pious people, religious people. I don't normally talk badly against them. But there are people who have gone off their rockers and people who have lost it a little bit. Rabbi Landau is an old man, and I believe that he's not thinking straight. Because if he were thinking straight, he would realize that there are over 6 million Jews living in Israel. And the Israeli army protecting the Jewish lives living in Israel, forget about Zionism, forget about politics, protecting Jewish lives living in Israel is not an abomination of the Torah, but is a blessing to the Torah. It's a concept called pekuach nefesh. It's a concept called saving a life. And Jews are allowed breaking every Jewish law in order to save a life. Nothing stands in the way of saving a life. And so the soldiers who are fighting to rid Gaza, rid other countries from Lebanon to Syria of terrorists that are trying to take Jewish lives, are performing the greatest mitzvah, the greatest good deed of them all. They're saving a life. In fact, the ethics of our Sfarad say that to save one life is like saving the world. And so hearing a top leader of the Lithuanian sect saying that he doesn't believe that the soldiers are doing a service to Judaism is very hurtful. But not hurtful because I'm a Zionist, but hurtful because I'm a Jew. It's hurtful to the Jewish people for him to talk that way. And to me, he should follow his own advice. If you don't know what you're talking about, and politics isn't your thing, keep your mouth shut. It seems that sometimes these religious leaders tend to talk too much. Maybe they should just keep their mouths shut. But moving around the world, let's take a look at more Jew hatred, because the Reuben Gnagigilam, the majority stakeholder in the United Kingdom's Queen Park Rangers soccer team, wrote on his personal social media account calling armies to dismantle Israel and comparing the war in Gaza with the Holocaust. See, I was going to call it genocide. Comparing the war in Gaza with the Holocaust. He shared several posts that advocated for Israel's eradication, praised the proscribed terror group Hezbollah as a resistance fighter, and promoted conspiracy theories that Israel owns the U.S. In one post, he claimed that Israel plans to take control of the Arab world and said that Israel must be dismantled and brave Muslims of the world. What are you waiting for? Crush Zionism once and for all. In a separate post, he wrote, armies to Askba. Gnalilim also compared the IDF to Hamas, depicting the terrorist organization as more moral than the IDF, as well as claiming no rational person can now claim Hezbollah are the terrorists in this conflict, accusing the IDF, accusing Israel, saying that the IDF snipes women and children, while Palestinian terrorism do not. Reuben Gnalilim later issued an apology after being accused of promoting anti-Israel rhetoric by resharing multiple controversial posts on his personal LinkedIn page. In response to an investigation published by the Jewish Chronicle, Gagalarium commented, "My intention by posting on LinkedIn was to highlight the devastating impact of the conflict on innocent children and draw attention to humanitarian crisis. I greatly appreciate tolerance, diversity, and respect for all people, as my colleagues, employees, and friends will attest to." Yeah, that's like saying all my good friends are Jewish, so I can't be anti-Jewish. It doesn't work well. It doesn't sound well. I don't buy into it. The idea... And this is the hypocrisy of the entire left-wing pro-Hamas movement. And it's a huge hypocrisy that we must address and we must look at, and it's not talked about enough. In 2006, Ariel Sharon made a huge mistake when he pulled every Jew, every Jewish body, every building, every road, every fire hydrant, every last remnant of Jewish life out of Gaza. He did so because he believed at the end of his life, maybe the brain tumor was affecting his brain. He did believe at the end of his life that the two-state solution would probably be the best solution to secure Israel and to ensure peace in Israel. And Ariel Sharon pulled the Jews out of Gaza, and the Jews fought back, and I remember clearly, Jews fighting back and trying to save their homes and their neighborhoods. But the Israeli army dismantled everything and pulled everything out of Gaza. They even unburied all the bodies. They took the Jewish dead back to Israel and left Gaza a barren wasteland the way they found it in 1967 after they conquered it from Jordan and Egypt. And so, once they moved out in 2006, Gaza became Hamas land. And Hamas decided that they were going to use the former Jewish settlements, which were right on the border of Israel, and launch missiles into the Israeli population living in southern Israel. So towns like Sderot, which were massacred on October 7th, all these southern towns, Neroz, Sarot, all these southern towns that were massacred by Hamas on October 7th, for 10, 15, 18, 20 years, and I did it on purpose because it was intervals, in all the years between the 2006 withdrawal of Israel till October 7th, and including, and then after October 7th, in all the years, these people lived with bombs falling on their heads, indiscriminately launched into civilian populations, women and children, men, innocent people, being bombarded day and night with missiles coming into their country, coming into their land, landing on their heads. And the world remained quiet. The world remained not a sound. Nobody cared about the people of southern Israel. And we talked about it on the show for many years, that the people of southern Israel are suffering, that children growing up in southern Israel have post-traumatic stress disorder, that they don't know a life where they don't have to be 5 seconds away from a bomb shelter. They grew up at their kindergartens, their nurseries, had dual schools on above ground and below ground to protect them. It was definitely a humanitarian crisis. It was definitely a war crime, a continuous war crime. And it was definitely should have been responded to by the Israeli government, who did in a couple of instances go into Gaza to try to get it to stop. But really, the world should have been screaming and yelling that this is an unacceptable situation for people to be living in. People like Gennad Galerium should have been saying about Israel and about the people and the children of Sderot. He should have been saying, he should have been posting on LinkedIn about them, highlighting the devastating impact of the conflict on innocent children. Because innocent Jewish children didn't matter to these people. Because Jewish life didn't matter to these people. When it comes to children who are cheering 9/11 and children who are cheering October 7th and children who are running around on motorcycles hoisting the Hamas and Hezbollah flags and holding up guns, those children, those innocent children, as he put it, those are the ones who are impacted by the conflict. But nobody cares about the Israeli children that have been impacted by the conflict their entire lives. The people who are in their 20s who were kidnapped and then murdered by Hamas on October 7th, who lived their entire childhoods in bomb shelters, who lived their entire childhoods running scared that any second they could die with a bomb landing on their heads. Nobody cared about those people. Nobody cared. Nobody in the world said, oh, those poor innocent Israeli children who are now experiencing these bombs falling on their heads from Hamas. Not a word, not a syllable, not one word spoken about it. Not at the UN, not at the Red Cross. Nobody cared. And I'm not saying it's tit for tat because it really shouldn't be. But what I am saying is that the hypocrisy is glaring. The hypocrisy is glaring. Accusing the IDF of targeting women and children is blatantly false. But accusing Hamas of doing that is blatantly true. Yet these people, and I'm saying these people, I hate doing that, but I'm saying these people, choose to ignore attacks on Jews, choose to ignore attacks on Jewish populations, choose to ignore indiscriminate bombs coming in right now from the Houthis, landing indiscriminately into civilian populations. They ignore it because it doesn't fit their narrative. It doesn't fit the story they're trying to tell, that Jews are the enemy. Because if you looked at it in a proper way, if you looked at it in what's really happening, you would see that the state of Israel is the victim here, not the oppressor. You would see that this is not freedom fighting. There is a fine line between a freedom fighter and a terrorist. And it's a fine line, but it's a very distinct line. And when I taught a course on terrorism, which I've taught many, but when I teach my courses on terrorism, the first thing I try to do is I try to distinguish between what is a freedom fighter and what is a terrorist. Because I use the old adage, and this is the old adage I throw up on the board, and I say, okay, let's take this apart, because it's not true. The old adage is that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, and that's not true at all. Because there's a distinct difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter. What is a terrorist? What is a freedom fighter? Let's go through the definitions right now so we understand what I'm talking about. A terrorist is somebody who targets civilian populations in order to make a political point. So they attack civilians to pressure governments in order to make a political point. Terrorist groups include Hamas, Hezbollah, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, Islamic Jihad. These are terrorist groups because they attack civilian populations, innocent civilians. What is a freedom fighter? A freedom fighter are a group of rebels in a country who attack government and military installations to try to overthrow the government and to rid their country of what they see as an oppressive leader. And so you see that in third world countries mostly, and you see that in South American countries, where rebel groups get up and they overthrow the government. We saw that with Ceausescu in Romania, where rebel groups came up and they overthrew him and they hung him. You saw that in Iraq after the Americans destroyed Iraq. The rebel groups rose up, they took over the government, and they hung Saddam Hussein. You saw that in Egypt, where Sisi's army were a rebel army, and they overthrew the leadership in Egypt and took over the country in what was called the Arab Spring at the time. So we see these are freedom fighters because they're not interested in harassing the population. They're not interested in killing civilians. They're not interested in kidnapping innocent people and killing them to pressure governments. They're interested in overthrowing the government and installing a government that more fits their personal agenda. And so that is the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter. And so when the Israeli army goes into Gaza and they target Hamas operatives, the second you pick up a gun for Hamas — Hamas is, by the way, the elected government of the Arab areas. Not only, it's a misnomer to say that they were the elected government of Gaza, because that's not true. When the election was held, the one and only election in the Palestinian areas after Oslo was held, the Palestinian Liberation Organization did not win that election. Hamas won that election, and they were the government of the entire Arab areas, Judea, Samaria, the Arab areas of Judea and Samaria, and Gaza. The Americans and the Israelis did not like that at all. So what they did was they pushed them, physically pushed them into Gaza and left them in Gaza, where once they got into Gaza, they killed the Palestinian Liberation Organization and anybody who opposed them and took over Gaza by force. Gaza could have been the state of Palestine. Easily could have been the state of Palestine. Israel would have worked with them. They would have had a great GDP. They could have built resorts on their beachfront, and it could have been a tourist destination. It could have been really, really nice. But Gaza was run by Hamas, a group hell-bent on killing Jews everywhere, not dismantling Israel, not reclaiming Palestine as people claim. But the first clause in their constitution, in their original constitution, was the murder of Jews everywhere they live, no matter where they live, North America, Europe, doesn't matter where, was the murder of Jews. They didn't care so much about the land. They didn't care so much about liberating Palestine. They cared about murdering Jews. And that was their goal. And that's all they've done since taking over Gaza, trying to kill Jews. So let's be clear and let's use language clearly. Hamas is not freedom fighters. They're not rebels trying to overthrow a government. They're a terrorist organization that is deliberately targeting civilian populations to make a political point, which is the definition of terrorism. So let's be extremely clear when we talk. When we call Hamas a terrorist organization, that's what they are. There's no if, buts, or maybes. If they were really hell-bent on overthrowing Israel, they wouldn't have committed the October 7th massacre. There was no way that October 7th would have overthrown the country. There was no way for October 7th to have liberated Palestine, as people claimed that that's what they wanted to do. Now, that wasn't the goal of October 7th. In the words of their own people who came in and murdered Jews on October 7th, their goal was to kill, maim, rape, and destroy as many people as possible. That was the goal of October 7th. So let's not forget that. Let's remember that the evil of Hamas's goal was to destroy Jews on October 7th. That was it. There was no other ulterior motive. Kill as many people as possible. Rape, destroy them. That's it. That's not freedom fighting. That's terrorism. If their goal was to overthrow the army, if their goal was to assassinate the Israeli political leadership, if their goal was to overthrow the government and take over as new government, that would have been a totally different story. But that wasn't the goal. That's never been the goal. Blowing up a bus in Tel Aviv, blowing up a bus in Jerusalem, blowing up a supermarket or a pizza parlor, that's targeting innocent civilians. That's not targeting military or governmental offices. You want to overthrow a government, you don't take out the population, you take out the government. That's the definition between terrorism and freedom fighting. The Arabs have never been freedom fighting in Israel. It's never been a battle to destroy Israel. It's been a battle, a religious battle, to destroy Jews who they believe are infidels living on Muslim land, running Muslim land. And those people, like that rabbi, who claimed that living under Arabs would be better for everybody, are living in La La Land. They're living in delusion. Jews lived under Arabs. They lived as dhimmis, as second-class citizens who had to pay a special tax and couldn't walk on the same side of the road as Muslim people. They lived for centuries in Arab countries as dhimmis. We know what it is. And we also know that when these Arab countries decided enough was enough, the State of Israel existed, they threw the Jews out. Displaced hundreds of thousands of Jews who all went to Israel. Took their land, took their money, because that's what you do with second-class citizens. They don't have rights. They don't own anything. Because in Muslim countries, if you're not a Muslim, everything you own belongs to the state. It's a different kind of oppression. So let's not kid ourselves. Let's not pretend that life was better under the Arab rule. It really wasn't. Jewish self-determination is the only way that we could survive as Jews. And preserving Jewish life, preserving Jewish culture, preserving the Jewish religion should be the goal and the mainstay of world Jewry everywhere. But it's not, unfortunately. I'm Howie Silberger. Thank you for joining me. I'll see you next show. Have a great one.